All right, I just landed back from the Detroit area. I had a great class yesterday in Jackson, Michigan. What a great group of people. Real good stuff. Great venue. All those things were great. Here is something that I hear frequently, and it just happened to me. I'm talking to a guy on Instagram. He happens to be in a case law class in Florida. And, of course, the instructor is citing legal advice that's contrary to not only things that we've said, but the things that he's believed his whole career. So my response back to him is, here are the cases that we cited to give that legal advice. Where are the cases your legal instructor, quote unquote, is citing? So what's interesting is the legal instructor is confused. What the topic of conversation is, and I'm going to lead into my advice here for everybody. Topic of conversation is the use of handcuffs does not automatically convert an investigative detention into a full-blown arrest. How do I know? I don't know. There's hundreds of cases nationally. Each state has quite a few themselves, at least one usually. What that means is during investigative detention, if there are safety issues, and some of the safety issues that have been tested are, it happened just after a fight, the police showed up, there might have been a weapon involved, somebody's dangerous, some kind of safety issue. Handcuffs, or the use of handcuffs, being employed to control the situation is acceptable by the courts, and it does not convert a Terry-style stop or investigative detention into a full-blown arrest. Now, once those safety issues diminish and deteriorate, the handcuffs and confinement must be removed. People must be released, essentially, quote-unquote. But the handcuffs must be removed, or you will roll into a de facto arrest. So that's the law. I mean, you know, everybody knows, and I'm trying to get everybody to understand that you can use handcuffs to take them off later on, and you're not going to affect the full-on arrest. Failure to do so may run into a de facto arrest where a police officer doesn't even intend to arrest somebody because of the circumstances surrounding the use of handcuffs and confinement. You may spark something called a de facto arrest where it had to be supported by the Fourth Amendment for the actions that were taken. And it would not. It would be a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But it's clear as day. Like, everybody knows this. Yet this instructor is explaining to them, as we're talking about a scenario, and I'm not there, but he starts reciting Mendenhall factors, U.S. versus Mendenhall, which really had nothing to do with that. So this instructor is coming up with their own fucking theory on, and again, I'm not there. So then he said, well, Miranda would kick in because you'd be, I'm like, well, hold on a second. What about Berkman v. McCarty? Berkman v. McCarty said, and this, I think this comes out of, your McCarty was in the 70s. McCarty talked about, could have been the late 80s, early 80s, forget the date on it. They talked about when a person is in custody, that is when Miranda is needed before an interview can begin with questions designed to elicit a confession or an incriminating statement. What they did test in Berkman v. McCarty was, in an investigative detention, Miranda is not required, right? And by the way, on a quick side note, it never hurts to read Miranda, but it's not required. Police officers should know when Miranda attaches, and that's when somebody believes, or a reasonable person believes, that they are going to be in custody in the amount of custody comparable to a full-blown arrest. That's why a traffic stop, as police officers, we're allowed to ask questions, even if they're incriminating in nature, without the reciting of Miranda. We have a piece of case law that dictates this. And this guy's saying, if you use handcuffs, then the confession would be tainted. Maybe a factor to consider, but not an end-all and be-all, right? So what are we doing? And now this leads to my next piece of advice. We really try to do our best to ensure that the information that we're giving you is factual and accurate. Myself and other legal instructors of this company try to communicate back and forth and try to deliver it to you in a way that you can use it, understand it, and cite it when need so. It really does fall on you often to read the case law yourself, get a firm understanding of it, and know how to apply it in the field. Those are three important pieces of knowing how to recite case law. The good news about this is when you're sitting in a update search and seizure class and something sounds funky or fishy or doesn't make any sense, what we can say is, well, hold on a second. We have a firm understanding of the law dictates. Why are you telling us the latter? It is amazing to me. Still to this day, I find it unbelievable that people who are tasked with the duty of educating police officers in this time an era of the of society and where we are and how we're under the magnifying glass more now than ever, are still misleading and misguiding police officers. When you misguide police officers legally, not only is there a civil issue, but now we've got safety issues because you have police officers not to be afraid to use handcuffs because they think they're going to create an arrest when the use of handcuffs would have been authorized and may have saved their lives. It's a big responsibility with delivering factual and correct information. Now, one thing I want to give you is that we want to have this discussion and conversation in a diplomatic manner. Emotions getting involved will never resolve anything. So cooler heads always prevail. I asked for this instructor's phone number to try to see where they're at. Now, there have been times where somebody has miscommunicated to me what the message was, and that's why I don't call, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? No, I'm like, hey, look, this guy called me and said that this is the things that are being discussed, and I've had, not very often, but some people say, that's not what I said. And I go, okay, you know, I figured as much. You're a legal advisor. You probably knew better than this. And the ones who get caught will never get on the phone with me. We have tried. I have managed to trick some of them to get onto the phone with me, and I've been hung up on. I've been texted that they don't discuss things with non-law enforcement personnel. I have spoken with them via email. They have denied emails. Folks, these people get caught and don't own up to the responsibility of raising their hand saying, you know what, I was wrong. I should have known better because they're embarrassed. That's part of the deal, man. If you're going to go out and be a police legal instructor, that's part of the deal. So when you hear something weird, whether it's from a coworker or at a class from an instructor, just raise your hand and say, that's all very interesting to me. Do you have the piece of case law that solidifies or that you're referencing in the advice that you're giving? Because it's not what I've heard. It's not what I've read. And that's what it all comes down to. That's why we continue to win conversations, because there's a reasonable interpretation of what the case law dictates. And if you don't understand or interpret it correctly, we'll help you understand what they were getting at. And it can be tricky at times, but if you're a police legal advisor, wouldn't you think it'd be a really good idea to know what you're talking about before you decide to stand in front of a class? You know what I mean? It's quite interesting. On a quick side note, I happened to go to some event. I'm going to keep it very vague. And at this event, I tell this story, there was a case law class going on in a different room. So I went to this room. And we had there was a guy from a state, I don't want to name the state, some people reveal what event it was, who was reciting case law from his state to a group of people from around the country. So I raised my hand. I'm like, are you teaching Ohio? Sorry, I fucked it up. It is what it is. Are you teaching Ohio case law to police officers from around the country? That's only particular to Ohio. The cases you're discussing are only particular to Ohio. Not only was he doing that, but he was actually encouraging, wink, wink, hinting that police officers should find other ways to circumvent the Fourth Amendment. This is not the type of people that we need. And there was confusion because how it was explained to me is that he really likes the cops. Don't get confused on somebody who really likes the police versus somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. We all tend to gravitate, especially in a world like this, when somebody likes us. We tend to find ourselves being attracted to them, and not in a sexual manner. I'm saying just as a personality. And the unfortunate truth about that is, it doesn't mean the person you're talking with is the wisest, because their position on police is that they like them. So just some food for thought. Be very weary about the people that you're getting advice from. And to be honest with you, if you're sick of it, you can do something about it. You can buy a book on case law. I've made several references to books that you can purchase and read through things. But don't forget, there's even some books out there that, and we've discussed this, Zach Miller and I, who's our legal instructor for the company. I'll call him the head legal guy, right? You know, that at times, some of these authors for these books, it's their perspective on how they're interpreting the law. So there's got to be a fair, unequivocal interpretation of the law for us to understand what we're talking about. And we try to do our best to deliver it. You know, I think about often, is everything that I'm giving exactly factual? Am I interpreting it correctly? And I can't hold out on teaching but I will redact information or a topic before I get complete clarity on it. And I have a full confidence that I'm giving correct and factual information. There have been times in the past where I even misinterpreted something. And it was the good news is when I did, I wasn't giving ill advice. I was giving an additional step that wasn't necessary, but would never hurt you. It was just a step. So I was comfortable knowing, okay, well, at least the things that I said 7 years ago on that one topic was not one that was going to be detrimental to anybody. It was sane and sound advice and always playing it safe if ever in doubt. And I sent an email out, this is like 7, 8 years ago, and I'm like, hey, my bad. Look at this. I didn't know this existed. Somebody brought it to my attention. I'm doing the best that I can, and it comes from a good place. And I really understand the responsibility of us being these people for you guys to depend on. And I really think it's a time that we need to start holding other people accountable for the things that they say and do. And if you don't have accountability or don't know what you're talking about, then you shouldn't be the person doing it. And that goes for me. I made a reference in class yesterday. I was like, hey, if somebody wants to, one of my kids comes to me and asks something about something that I'm very familiar with, I'm going to be right there to give them the advice. My third son likes baseball. If he comes to me and asks me how to improve his swing, I got to turn him on to my cousin Mikey, who lives, breathes, eats, and shit. My cousin Chris. They love baseball. So don't ask me. Ask your cousin. I'm not the expert on how to improve your batting swing. I stopped playing baseball in the eighth grade. Didn't want to do it anymore. Wanted to work. I started seeing boobies, right? Like those things were more important to me. That's why I got out of sports. I just didn't care about it anymore. So I'm not the guy. Just some food for thought. But one thing I want to offer to you is diplomacy, right? Be diplomatic with your approach when we're talking about clearing the air, getting to the answer for real. Because if you're wrong, you're going to sound three times worse if you didn't approach it in a diplomatic situation or circumstance. I say, if you can understand and begin to grow yourself as somebody who has really thoughtful candor, right? Like really, really, really thoughtful candor about how you are communicating. It almost never comes back and bites you in the ass. It's like being nice on a traffic stop. If you're super nice on a traffic stop, people are far less inclined to file a complaint against you, number one. But even if you're wrong, I've had people, literally, I screwed up and I'm like, you know what? I was wrong. They're like, nah, it's okay. You were like the nicest cop I ever met in my life. There are probably times where I deserved maybe some kind of at least acknowledgement for something that I did was a mistake, wasn't intentional. And I don't mean a good acknowledgement, I mean a bad acknowledgement. And it didn't go that route because I was kind. And people just will not find themselves to be vengeful. Not everybody, but a far majority of normal human beings will not be vengeful against you when you're deploying kindness. They are inclined to complain about you when you behave and act inappropriately. There's never a reason or why we need to act inappropriately as law enforcement. And that's not only to the public, but professionally. And a lot of times you don't hear that. Nobody's told you that. Nobody sees that. It's a hard dynamic to figure out when you're a new guy, right? I always tell people, it's very hard to figure out. It's not an easy thing to understand how you're going to behave and act. So, you know, just some food for thought there. Anyway, hope you guys found some value today. Do it the right way. See you guys.